Hello there, I'm Patricia Glynn, and this is Storycatcher. Simple stories, simply told. Welcome to Potpourri, a monthly collection of short stories. They're universal, they're everyday, and they're about the kind of dramatic events, small joys, and certain sorrows that happen in all our lives. Most importantly, they're your stories, submitted by you and recorded as I travel the subcontinent in my beloved truck, Lady Alexandra. So you're in charge of where I go and when. Please get your suggestions to me as soon as you can via our submissions page so that I can collate the stories by theme and or region and then set off. Welcome to our November collection of short stories. They feature the Magaliesberg region of South Africa, a place of astonishing richness in geography, history, culture, paleoanthropology, and diversity of people. Really, we've got it all. I know I'm biased, but we've got it all. And I hope our tales today are as varied as the people who tell them. Vicky Brooker is one of my guests this month, and her closest friends are lions and elephants. She'll tell you why. Johnson Masinga is the best-spoken petrol attendant in the land, hands down. We have a beautiful love story from the Boer War, and Jenny Gillis takes us back 43 years to the day she heard a squeal from under a bush on her farm. That squeal changed her life. But we begin very close to home. Now, where are those?
Yeah, my lekker koffie and los die ander uit. Right. Now, I'm all yours.
Whew, that's a scary thought. Well, I do. I have to. You're the price of paradise.
I'm the booby prize. So poor people.
Who, the Boera? Well, I don't think so simple.
My fork.
That's my landlord, Louis Steyn. And he and his wife, Elsaby, once lived in a house which is about 200 metres down, further down the hill from my camp. It's an ugly old dear, is the house, and it was bought for the Steyns by a friend because they were living abroad at the time.
When I met him, one of the first things he said, there's something weird about the house. I said, what's weird about the house? He said, well, you know, I've got the Alsatians. They don't seem to be worried, but the cat has a problem with the house. It doesn't want to be in the house. Its fur raises as if it's seeing something or something is troubling it. I said, okay. Sorry for the cat. A very ramshackle house, really. I subsequently built a little bit on, not very successfully, because the walls kept moving away from where I was building.
Yes, let me just say, you're a typical Sunday architect. Don't give up your day job, Lou.
This is so. But I carry on regardless, you know. Anyway, we eventually moved into the house, and I started to add to it slowly but surely. And that's when these strange happenings occurred. Voices, while we were in our room asleep, we could hear voices in the corridor. Both wife and I, you could hear people arguing. I mean, the strangest things. I'd jump out and go and look, and there was absolutely nothing.
What, a man and a woman, I think you said.
A man and a woman. Mm-hmm. Both in Afrikaans, but raised voices. And often there was just footsteps up and down the corridor. This continued, and I blanked it out, but Elsie didn't. And then she saw the figure of a woman, a vague shape, but identifiably a woman, at night in the dark.
Was this in the bedroom?
In the bedroom. And then I was alone in the house. Elsie was away for a short while. And I woke up and saw the figure of It wasn't as clear as it was to her, the figure of a girl or woman. And for some reason, it didn't disturb me at all. Anyway, I told Elsie, she got back, well, I saw your famous ghost. And we decided perhaps it was some sort of unhappy soul that was trying to get some sort of message across to us. And I said, well, why don't you give her a name and tell her she's welcome any time in the house. And we'll kind of just adopt her as our resident ghost. So she said, no, I don't like that idea. I don't like the idea of ghosts. Anyway, I said, okay, well, at least let's give her a name. It just so happened that I'd been chatting to an old mate of mine, an English guy, and he grew up in Boysons. You see, just behind the Boysons police station, which is a rough area. And I had been talking to him that. So I said, I know, let's call her Mrs. Boysons. And she said, fine, she's Mrs. Boysons. And I'll try my very best to keep her happy by making sure the house is clean and the dishes are washed and whatnot. Anyway, strangely, Mrs. Boyson then didn't appear for quite some time and we didn't hear the noises anymore.
Then Mrs. Boyson started behaving like a very typical poltergeist, interfering with physical objects, as if speaking to the living wasn't enough to draw their attention. She particularly liked anything electrical.
We had strange things happening with electrical appliances. Mm. Normally lights that would switch on for no reason. A radio that would switch on or off for no reason. So, yes, there were strange happenings. And, of course, the displacement of objects was always explainable in that you've put it down somewhere else and you look for it for 2 days and then you find it exactly where you first looked. But that could, you know, that could always be explained away. It's just a memory lapse or you didn't look properly or something. But there were so many of them that it was a little bit disconcerting, yes. And then we had the funniest incident was an old hunting mate of mine from Zambia. Who was a hard-assed ex-SASC squadron right through the Rhodesian Honda War, became a game ranger. He was really a hard guy. And he was visiting here, and the house was still very small then, so we didn't have a guest room. So we made a bed with cushions and stuff in front of the fireplace. It was in winter, and there was a fire in the grate. We chatted until late, pretty late, and there was alcohol involved, as there should be always on these occasions. And we went off to bed. The next morning, when we came out, he was in the kitchen making coffee. And he said, I don't know if I should quote exactly what he said, because there are a few expletives in it. But basically, it boiled down to, is this a ghost in your house? I said, Dan, what the hell are you talking about? And we know there's a ghost in our house, but we don't really worry about it. He says, well, I do. He says, I've never had such a cold feeling in my entire life. And trust me, I've been in some strange places. When I went onto my cushioned bed, the fire had almost burned completely out. There was a slight glow from the coals. And what woke me was heat. There was a roaring fire, a total roaring fire in the grate, which literally I had to move away from. And I took my blankets and I got out of the goddamn house into my car. And I slept in my car. I said, you're a wuss.
So the feeling of coldness then, yeah, wasn't a literal one. It was, you know, something untoward.
Oh, absolutely. He said, no. He said, there's something very, 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 very spooky going on. So we left it at that. And then the next incident, really, I mean, I skip the little incidents that happened along the way, which you could explain or not explain, or which could have been normal noises, but were a bit abnormal, and they were still the odd argument taking place. On a Sunday, we were having a snooze, and my good and trustful farm labourer, Rapson, who's now been with me for more than 20 years, he came and he said, at the back gate, there's somebody in a car, a white man and a white woman. And they say they're very sorry, but they think this is the farm where they used to live. So I said, well, all right, I'll go and see what's happening. But there was a man of about 50-something, and a young woman, youngish woman, I would have thought about 28, 29, sitting next to him. And she came to the gate. She said, oh, I'm terribly sorry, but in Afrikaans, okay, very Afrikaans. I'm terribly sorry, but I just resigned from the army. I'm on my way to Iraq as a contractor. And I wanted to come and see the old farm somewhere in this area. And as far as we could work out, that must be in this area. So I said, well, by all means, come in. So I opened the gates. Come and have a cup of coffee anyway. And the moment she saw the house, she said, this is it. It's not the same as it was, but this is the house that I grew up in. And she said, are the fig trees still here? I said, yes, there's a whole fig orchard there in front. And the peaches, I said, no, the peach trees are no longer there. I never saw them. She said, my father had trouble with his legs, and he and my mother were very, very unhappy here. And we were unhappy here because of it. And they were always fighting. She then explained to us how hard her childhood had been there, how father, he wasn't crippled completely, but he had to walk sometimes with crutches, sometimes with a stick. He couldn't do things. So that in itself, you know, being on a farm and not being able to do things, that made him very difficult to live with. And he shouted at his wife and she shouted back and things like that.
So just let me clarify this. Her parents were very unhappy, but did they die in unusual circumstances? Because often these ghosts are attached to human existences that come to an end.
They were both dead by that time.
But they didn't die from a hanging or whatever.
No, okay. Both natural deaths.
So Louis and Elsie's ghost must have been that of the woman whose tortured married life played out within those walls. Eventually, their young visitor got up to leave. And as she did, Louis said, by the way, what was your mother's name? Mrs. Boysons was her reply. After the visit of her daughter, Mrs. Boysons didn't appear ever again. Another windy day in my camp, I'm afraid, so you will hear a fair bit of canvas flapping. I heard our next story at a local pub from Jenny Gillis, the woman to whom this happened. Jenny has a country retreat here and she's a cattle farmer. She lives on a gorgeous farm, and it was on this farm that the following events occurred.
He and I were on the farm with a whole lot of our friends, and we went for a walk and we heard this noise and we found this baby. He couldn't even scream anymore. He was going, eh! I thought it was an animal trapped somewhere. And I thought the mother was definitely coming to fetch this baby because it's left in the middle of the veld with a little bag next to him with all his goodies in, his bottles and a couple of clothes and whatever else.
Was he in some kind of shelter?
No. No. He was in a blanket.
With the sun beating down on his face?
Well, under sort of a half a bush, but it wasn't really a big bush.
And tell me, was he placed so that somebody would find him?
Well, it's a difficult question, that, because he was definitely placed in an area where people would walk. It wasn't right in the middle of nowhere. There was a path going quite near, which is what we were on when we heard this noise. And so I got one of our workers to sit under this bush and wait, because the mother's going to come back. But I took him down to the farmhouse in the meantime. And I then tried to... He was like a tiny bird, because he was... We found out later he was 6 months old, but he was literally skin and bone. He was that big, a foot long. So when I took his nappy off and I put him in the kitchen sink to try and wash him, half his bum came away, the skin, because of the... You know, being in a nappy for so long, the same nappy and all of that. He had fly sores around his mouth and inside, on the outside and inside. And he was in a very bad way. In fact, that night he would have died.
In the felt.
Yeah.
In his own, bless his heart. How long do you think he'd been there?
We think a day and a half. This was about 5 o'clock at night. So he would have died that night. So that evening, the first thing I did, once I'd washed him and seen what a bad way he's in, I took him to a local doctor, and he said he's got pneumonia in both lungs, and said he's very badly dehydrated and malnourished, and therefore you can't feed him milk. You can feed him Darrah's water in a syringe, which we did for the first 3 days.
I don't know what that is. Darrah's water.
Darrah's water is sugar water.
Okay.
In a syringe, which we had to squirt into his mouth and force feed him. And then the doctor actually said to me, you can leave him here and I'll sort it out.
What did he mean by that?
Well, nobody knows, but this is now the beginning of 1981, so you can only presume that he's either going to call the police, he will flush him down the toilet, or he'll get rid of him in some way. So I said, no, I'm not going to leave him here, I'll take him home. I was at the stage about 21.
Wow.
So, you know, we were not married, I was 21, you know, we were young people. But we looked after Ben for the weekend, and he started to improve. I mean, it was terribly traumatic because he screamed for the first 2 days, nonstop. And so I took him to our domestic worker on the farm, who's like my granny, because she worked for my folks for a million years. And I said, Peggy, you have to look after him. I've got to have some sleep. Anyway, we get through the weekend, and we leave him with Peggy. And we come back, and we go to work, and we do whatever. And we go back to the farm on Friday. And then we get him from Piggy, and he's now starting to improve. Took him back to the doctor, check everything, more antibiotics, etc., whatever. And then he was really kind of getting on the road to recovery. And we went and reported it to the police that we'd found a baby. But the police only came about 4 weeks later.
And you then, I'm sure, you started trying to find out who he came from. How did you do that?
So we spoke to our staff on the farm, whose families had been there for a very long time. And we asked at the local Indian store, which supplies everything from nappies to bicycle tires to whatever. So nobody could pinpoint where he came from. And whether they didn't inform us or what, I don't know. But we don't know to this day. We don't know who dumped him, etc., etc. But there's a sequel to this, which we can go into just now. Now, of course, at that time, white people couldn't have a black child. So we registered him as a foster child with our domestic worker. And she was a wonderful woman, but very elderly. She was a person I greatly admired and respected. And she was like my granny, so she became like Ben's granny, actually. Anyway, so when Ben needed to go to school, we looked around Joburg. Of course, there were no Model C schools in those days. So we went to the private schools and we put him into the Ridge.
As a tiny boy?
Yeah, he was 5. From that time onwards, he hasn't really looked back. He went from there to Kearsney. He then went to Stellenbosch and he's done a degree. And when he was living with us permanently in Joburg, obviously we knew that in 1992, they were starting to change the laws. So in 1992, when he was 11... we started an adoption procedure. And so in that year, we adopted him when he was 11. But when he was 8, I had my daughter, Kieran. And then 3 years later, we had a son, Bryn. These three kids today are adults. So Ben is 44, Kieran is 35, and Bryn is 32 or something like that. But these kids have never seen anything different. And I suppose once they realized there was a thing called race, he's their brother, and that's the way it is. So the difficulty with Ben, if there was a kid's party and it was at the movies, Ben couldn't go.
Oh, Lord, you see, you forget about that.
Ben didn't go to a movie in a movie house until he was 7 and a half, nearly 8. So wherever there was a party, I had to check out, like, where is it? And would he be able to go? And when we went on holiday, where did we go? The Tong Sky. We had to go somewhere. We couldn't go to Umhlanga. So we used to go to the Tong Sky. And so we never told him about this nonsense. So we protected him from it. We never told him that we had to phone. I just said, sorry, you can't go to that party. We're busy that weekend. Mm. We really tried to shield him. And I think that in some ways, I think it's been a benefit to him. Because I think that there are a lot of angry people who feel badly done by, and he's not one of them.
So you said earlier that there was a follow-up to when you were trying to find who this baby might belong to.
We did have somebody who arrived on the farm, and he was a coke truck driver, and he wanted to take the child away. He said it was his child that someone had abandoned there, and we just said, if you want to do anything, go to the police. Go and get the police and whatever, and we never saw him again.
So do you grant this woman a very compassionate reason for why that baby was in the film? She was desperate?
No. I don't at all. Because I think if you'd understood the trauma and the dreadfulness that this child was in, the state he was in, I will never forgive that woman. Because you don't just dump the child in the veld. Take it to the church, take it somewhere, outside a shop, on the pavement, wherever, but not in the middle of the veld. I've said to him, if you ever make contact with somebody, I'm telling you, Ben, you're not bringing her to my place, because I will either shoot her or I will call the police, because there's no prescript on murder or attempted murder. So that's how I feel. I feel very, very cross.
Resolute and, angry.
And angry. I'm angry that somebody could do that.
Because, you know, around here, they're not a jackal.
It's a miracle.
He could have been taken
by a jackal. It's a miracle.
Especially when he started smelling, may I just say.
And shouting.
The fact that he could still scream is what saved him.
Yeah, make a little noise, yeah.
And he's turned out to be a strong boy, hasn't he? A strong guy.
He's hugely strong. He's extremely determined. He's exactly like his mother, which is so funny. And so we argue because he's exactly the same as me. It's so funny that an adopted child becomes exactly like the adoptive mother. And the other kids are different, but him and I are exactly the same.
The amazing Jenny Gillis. You might know her name from the shelter she founded for street kids called Twilight Children. As if four kids and a top corporate job weren't enough back then. These days she has a lovely country retreat called Pefumula, Pefumula. Caters especially for romantic couples. And now I realise I'm flipped out.
Diesel.
Diesel, please.
Yeah.
I think, just give me 500 rand, would you?
Yes. The weather in summer is so unpredictable.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm reading Collins Huhu, Good to be Great. Have you come across that?
I have, yes.
Yeah, it's a good... It says we must progress from being good and be great.
Now, when a petrol pump attendant, and especially one in South Africa, asks you if you've read Good to Great, you can bet they've got a story of unusual tenacity.
Ninjano.
Johnson Masinga is a local chap, and he went to a pretty ordinary school. Most rural schools in South Africa are pretty ordinary. But he had one teacher who encouraged him to better himself. And he didn't rely only on what he was being taught in the classroom.
Well, I picked this up, you know, I would say self-educated with the help of my school, because I really did go to school. And I must just mention that I did go to school. And the thing that made me inspired, it's the English teacher that I had. She was my namesake too, Johnson Munshu. The surname is Munshu. So every time he came to class, he would say to us, kids, I see you always, when you see me, you don't do anything. But when you see me, what do? You pick up your books and make yourself so busy. Meanwhile, you are not. Let me tell you. The nice thing that you can do to improve yourself, to improve your knowledge, and to know more things is to gather information. And he said, let me tell you, when I say gather information and strengthen yourself with it, it's to read. He says, knowledge, it's reading.
And if you have an ear for accent as well as language, it opens all sorts of doors. And the doors that swung open for Johnson were at a wedding and conference venue where he worked his way up from washing dishes behind the bar to arranging weddings. He even wrote their newspaper.
Just after a month I was there, compliments. The boss also again came to me again. Now himself says, Johnson, you have grown out of this job,
yeah.
No, you're old for it. So they said, now, because we are going to expand now, we will have front of office, but I don't have something to back it up. Then what it is? I said, it's studying towards this field I'm in. Then I started saying, I'm going to do business management, it was holistic. It teaches you about marketing. It teaches you about HR. It teaches you about public relations. Everything was just encompassed in the study. So I did that, sales as well.
So he signed up for a course in business management. Then it all came tumbling down.
7 years without work.
Yeah.
Wow. What did you just stay at home? What did you do?
Stayed at home. And I did odd jobs. You don't have to be choosy. When the situation, you've got to be able to adjust to the situation. So when the situation is bad, don't put or throw your hands in the air and say, well, my God, it's the end of the world. There's always an opportunity. There are loads of opportunities out there. There are people who've got farms. So come and do this for me. Come and do that. Come and work in my garden. Work hard. So I worked hard and we survived for the 7 years, just towards the end of the 7 years. So I walked into the garage and voila, there was this man. And you know, without hesitation, I came with all this donkey. I came with all these huge papers. Your resume.
Yes.
So he gave as big as a Bible. I came with it, but he took it. Yes. All right. Okay. No, we'll talk. Then I don't know what happened. In the middle of the shop, I'm outside. He turned and said, "Can you come? Can you come tomorrow?"
I was so excited.
Johnson started in the garden and eventually made it to the forecourt, where his personality is as infectious as his language is persuasive.
Oh, I love the smell. Johnson, we're getting high again.
We are.
I've got this theory that's why Johnson is so bubbly, because he's high. He's high as a kite the whole time.
Johnson has been a pump jockey for something like 7 years now and doesn't seem to have a shred of resentment that his life has taken this turn.
Everything has now progressed from being good to great.
Somehow, I don't think you're going to be good for long. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Ta-ta. Bye.
Our next story brings into focus the important issue of demonstrable truth, probability, and human fallibility. Many stories that come my way as I crisscross the country will be personal and intensely human. They probably won't be found in history books or biographies. They won't have been studied to bits, or researched, or even meticulously analysed. They will be the kind of legends and folk tales that are handed down from mother and father to child over generations, the stuff of family history, of the mythology that helps us make sense of the human condition and our place in the cosmos. And here comes a stunning storm. Anyway, so some of the important details in these stories remain intact over time. Some will be forgotten and some will be embellished or omitted as a matter of convenience. Oral history is a tricky thing. But as we learned from Homer's Iliad and his Odyssey, our lives and understanding of ourselves would be impoverished without these human truths that are passed down by word of mouth. The Legend of the Flowers, our next story, is just that, a legend. Some aspects of it are patently provable, others aren't. So what should we believe and what should we discount? It's a tricky business, as I said, but uncertainty doesn't take away from the enduring beauty of this heartbreaking love story of two more star-crossed lovers.
In the small, dusty, hot little town of Ventersdorp in the northern province, lie the remains of one Private George Frederick Shaw, buried 50 metres away from the 38 colleagues that died during the Anglo-Boer War. And the story that we came across was unbelievable.
That's the voice of Roger Webster, well-known storyteller and lay historian who scoured South Africa for tales of our past. He's gone now, but in the 90s and 2000s, he had a show on SAFM, our national broadcaster, called Fireside Chats. This was one of his favourites, this story, and it has become known as the Legend of the Flowers, as I said. Its backdrop was a period in British colonial history which must surely go down as one of its most shameful. As a military tactic, which later became known as the Scorched Earth Policy, Lord Kitchener ordered his soldiers to burn down every Boer farmhouse they came across, seize the horses, the fodder, the food, and capture the women, children, and workers for internment in the notorious concentration camps that had been set up at various sites around the country. Little attention was paid to hygiene and health in those camps, and as many as 25,000 civilians died from dysentery and other diseases. The lovers in our story escaped those dreadful camps, but their fates were arguably worse.
George Frederick Shaw was a young Irishman of 21 years of age when he came out to this country, and being a hot-blooded Irishman, he fell in love with a Boer woman called Marta Engelbrecht. As fate would have it, his job was to burn her farm down. They arrived at her farm, and she just fell on her knees, and she was crying and begging him to stop. And she said, "How can you burn my farm? You are my lover." He had a stand-up row with his commanding officers. He refused to burn the farm. And his officer turned around and said, "Shaw, if that's the way you feel, why don't you go and join the Boers?" He did. That night he left the camp, he buried his British Army uniform, and he joined the Boers. He got a job as a transport rider, unarmed, which was very clever. And he stayed with Marta. And he was captured, and he was at the station in Ventersdorp about to be sent off to a concentration camp, and everybody was receiving their rations. Shaw, being a trained British soldier, when he received his rations, he stood to attention, and a soldier on duty said, "That is not a Boer," he said, "That is a Tommy," and they arrested him. They found out who he was, and they court-martialed him for desertion. They gave him a shovel and a spade, and they marched him to the cemetery. And he paced off 50 paces away from consecrated ground. And they tied him to a chair, which is still here to this day. Belongs to the Kricher family in Klerksdorp. The firing squad was instructed to miss on the first volley, which I find particularly shocking, and reload, and they shot Shaw.
Roger recorded that account of George Shaw's death about 25 years ago, and he was introduced to the story by Rob Milne. Rob is a collector and curator of Magaliesburg stories from the past, big and small. He's an author and guide, and when I realized that he too was living in the Magaliesburg, not far from Ventersdorp, I asked him to take me to see Shaw's grave and the little house where he and Marta had loved and lived.
So I gather from reading your story...
It was a couple of decades since Rob had last been there, and the graveyard was now forlorn and untended. Many of the older gravestones had toppled over, and the metal crosses of George Shaw's fellow British soldiers had been removed for scrap metal, can you believe it? Small piles of stones were placed where each cross had been, perhaps put there by someone who wanted to give these soldiers just some acknowledgement of their deaths in this hard and foreign
disgusting
land.
Okay, let's go and find the grave.
Okay. All right.
We started the search for Shaw's grave by doing exactly what he had done.
12, 14, 15, 16, 17.
I wondered if Shaw also counted the paces to his grave in a kind of countdown to the end of his life. Or did he leave that to his killers as he prayed and tried to keep a grip on his emotions? Perhaps he thought only about the woman he was leaving behind.
50, 49, 50. I'm on about 50 paces.
Just looking. There it is. There it is.
Wow.
There it is. The pine tree, you can still see the stem of the pine tree.
The base of the trunk?
Yes.
Wow.
And the pepper tree was on the other side, more or less where the wall is.
For Marta Engelbrecht, the pepper tree symbolized bitterness and the cypress life. Rob will tell us why she chose those trees later, but there are several unanswered or unanswerable questions about Shaw's execution.
you'll see that there's no date of death on his grave.
Okay? Oh, yeah.
And remember, this was outside of consecrated ground. And so I wanted to do some further research on the circumstances of his execution and maybe even get a copy of the court-martial document. So my father visited the records office in London, and eventually they tracked down where his court-martial was recorded. And when he opened the book, he found that the pages had been cut out with a razor blade and they were gone. So there's no record of that court-martial. So it's very strange, no date of death, and that these court-martial records were deliberately cut out of this book. So there had to be another story behind that that we'll probably never, ever know.
All very curious, and one wonders if a thorough search through all the different military records of the time, and there were several, would lead to a deeper understanding of what happened that day. All we do know is that George Shaw's execution was, as executions invariably are, a brutal affair. Imagine then witnessing it. To the north of George's grave was a clump of trees, and legend has it that hidden from view, Marthe Engelbrecht stood silent witness to the ghastly death of her lover. In her belly, she carried his child.
So what she did after he was buried, she planted a pepper tree on the left-hand side of his grave and a pine tree on the other side, actually a cypress tree on the other side. And we'll go into the significance of that, which I managed to figure out after some exploration in the area.
And he figured it out by finding Marta's humble little home. And we now set out to find it again.
Search for the Hodibeus Hase to see if it's still standing. It was a little bit deteriorated 22 years ago.
A Hodibeus Hase was a type of cottage built by the early trekkers. It was constructed with layered stone and comprised only two rooms, sometimes with a veranda or stoop running the length of the house. And it was tiny, with an outside kitchen and toilet. To say that these homes were modest would be an understatement, and it makes the British act of burning them to the ground seem even more reprehensible. But the destruction of Marta's house didn't happen, for reasons we don't know. Perhaps her pitiful beseeching of the soldiers or George's of his superior officer moved them to desist with their actions.
So, no little Hasty, it seems.
Yes, it's now a sports field and a nice cell phone aerial. It probably became some sort of school, primary school, and then they've built very recently this school and these lovely sports fields. But I fear it's on the apple orchard was. And they've knocked down the Hodibeus Hase and to make way for a cottage and some carports.
So, how does it make you feel?
Well, it's very heart sore.
What is the significance of the apple orchard?
Well, that is where they fell in love, obviously, because that comes to the verse that was cited at Martha's funeral in 1957, where the minister said, "Many waters cannot quench the fires of love, neither can the floods drown it." But when I came here and I found the apple orchard and I looked towards the Hodibeus Hase, there I saw on the left-hand side a very old pepper tree and on the right-hand side a very old cypress tree. And so that gave me the connection as to why she planted the pepper tree on the left-hand side of George's grave and the cypress tree on the right. And it gets verified if you go a couple of verses before in Song of Songs. So how this goes is, "Under the apple tree I woke you, in the place where you were born," and that's where she was born. "Close your heart to every love but mine. Hold no one in your arms but me. For love is as powerful as death. Passion is stronger than death itself. It bursts into flame and burns like a raging fire. Waters cannot put it out, neither can the floods drown it.
It was an extraordinary love.
Yes.
That they shared.
Absolutely. And then there's another love story that we haven't even got into. And that's the love story with the man that she married later on, a friend of George Shaw's. Because in Victorian times, he brought this child into his family and treated him like a son, gave him his own name, John Fleischer Jr., and probably falsified the birth certificate. Because I believe John was born not in 1899, but in 1901. And I know when I met him...
1899 is what's written on his...
On his gravestone.
Yeah.
So, and he told me he was 100, and he died shortly after I met him, or probably a few 9 months after I met him. So I believe that everything was covered up.
It would have been for a very good reason. His mother's reputation would never have survived the revelation that she was pregnant with another man's child. John Fleischer Jr. wouldn't speak about his real father during the visit Rob paid him 22 years ago, but he burst into tears when Rob said he'd go and lay flowers on both of his father's graves. And those graves are within 200 meters of each other. So Marta lies next to John Fleischer for eternity, but within sight of her first love and the father of her child. But why is this great love story known as the Legend of the Flowers?
After George Shaw was executed, before the cemetery opened, she would gather wild flowers every Friday morning, and she would come here on her own, and she would place these flowers on his grave. And then she became old and sick, and she realized that she wouldn't be able to make this pilgrimage anymore. And so she laid some plastic flowers at his grave. And when I first visited the grave in 1987, I actually found those flowers there.
Marta Engelbrecht performed that secret act of love and tribute every single week of her life for 55 years. So the legend has it. Tragically, there are no photos extant of Marta or George, but Rob has given me permission to use some of his photos about the story, which you can find on the podcast page. You can read about the legend in Rob Milne's book, Anecdotes of the Anglo-Boer War. And if you'd like to visit the places where these events took place, those that are left, Rob will take you there. He can be found at robmilne.com. I have a very big, very soft spot for people who rescue, work with, study and home animals, domestic and wild. And one of them is my friend Vicky Brooker. She's the head of welfare and training for the big cats and elephants at the Glen Afrique Estate. And spending a day with her is a lesson in commitment, if ever there was one.
Hi. I know, and so don't get too close. You might just have a go. I know, it's a long story. Come here. Go, foof, foof. Did you hear that?
Oh, snort.
Teddy? Oh, isn't that beautiful? It's called chuffing.
And what is it an indicator of? What kind of communication?
Working with lions is so magic. There's no boyfriend, no husband, no son, no daughter, no any relationship that if you've got a great relationship with an animal like a lion, it's absolutely amazing. And that's just that huge amount of love you get from them.
So there's a lot in it for you and for us.
Yes.
Being with them. What's in it for them, though? Your lions, for instance. What's in it for
them? The lions that we have are all would have been shot, put down, and died. So they have a fabulous life, I think. They have a life where they are fed every second day. They have attention from us, which they absolutely love. This whole concept of animals in the wild. Animals in the wild battle. It's a hard, hard world for them there. It's a really hard world.
Vicky estimates she's worked with well over 100 lions so far, some rescued from dire circumstances.
You're from Somalia, aren't you? And I'm up there. How beautiful is this lion? Now, I'll tell you the story. How beautiful is this lion? Look at that face.
How beautiful is she? How perfect is she?
White eyeliner. Look at the width of this face.
No, look at the little hands like this.
But they're not little. Is this also a Somalian lion?
Yes, we've got three of them. Their parents were at the airport in Somalia. They were going to a zoo somewhere in Europe. And the people who had sold them to the zoo in Europe had not done the paperwork properly. And Somalian customs officials said they don't have the right paperwork, they can't go. They got in their car and drove away and left a male and a female lion in the hot sun in Somalia at the airport and was never seen again. So, obviously, they had to give them water and didn't quite know what to do with them. There's a girl, a South African girl, who goes to Somalia to do business or whatever, who is in the wildlife business. And they said, listen, please, you've got to do something with these lions. What do we do? Because we're going to have to shoot them. She said, you know what? I'll take them for you, from you. So she took them, the parents, and they arrived in South Africa, and they were in South Africa for a month or so. And the female popped out three little cubs. So she phoned us and she said, I cannot afford, I don't have the facility, whatever, to have five lions. I will have two, but I will not have five. So these lions you can have, or I'm taking them to the vet this morning to put down.
It needs to be said that some of the cats on Glen Afrique are bought and some are bred. All are caged, but in large enough camps so that they can walk around, lie in the shade, and have the company of others of their kind. Nonetheless, the fact that these animals have not been released into the wild or into ranges big enough that they can hunt and enjoy other aspects of their natural behavior has sometimes put Vicky and her colleagues in the crosshairs of animal rightists. What to do with animals in captivity, particularly the large cats and elephants? It's the subject of vigorous debate in South Africa, and it's likely to continue for a very long time. The fact is that most of these animals can't be released because they wouldn't survive in the wild. And that, to my mind, leaves only two options: either shoot them or keep them in comfortable captivity for the rest of their lives. But housing and feeding a big cat is extremely expensive. So, here again, there are two uncomfortable options. Depend on donor funding, which is unreliable at best, or put the animals to work, so to speak. Open the venues to tourists, for instance, paying volunteers or movie makers. Glen Afrique does all three, but I think it's true to say that it's performing for the camera that the animals most enjoy.
You know, we've done a lot of little series, movies, commercials, etc., which have done huge amounts of good for the farm. You know, these lion camps are over 100,000 rand to build. And, you know, they want a cheetah walking past them, whatever. So we do that. We throw one piece of meat over there and then we run to the other side behind the camera, went to throw another piece of meat, and the cheetah ambles through the shot while there's dialogue in a vehicle. And so it's all very easy. And I must say, I have been very fortunate to work with crews that when I say no, the animal's done, or that's too difficult, or whatever, they've listened to me. And we actually, one night in the pub, they said, you know, you amaze us. You won't let us do this and let the animal stand in the sun for a little while, because animals do, you know, Vicky, they stand in the sun. I said, no, if it's hot, they go under a tree. And they said, well, you won't let us do that, but you'll probably, if we asked you to take an elephant in the kitchen, you'd be quite happy to. I said, yes, I can do that. And they said, you can't. I said, we can. Anyway, the next day we did exactly that. We took the table out of the middle. I put an apple into the fridge, brought in the one elephant, and I opened the fridge and I showed the apple, put the apple in the fridge, closed the door, showed her the handle, took her out, and then called her in to do her own thing. She walked straight into the kitchen, opened the fridge, took out the apple, turned around and walked away. And it was fun. She thought it was clever. And it just depends what they're comfortable in doing.
Do you think they like people looking at them?
Oh, please. Pick up a cell phone with some of our giraffe we've had. I say to the crew, do not make eye contact or pick up your cell phone, because we will not get the giraffe from A to B. One giraffe we had here, he would be walking onto set, which we do out of the back of a bucket with a bucket of horse cubes. And he has a little nibble all the way through, like a little picnic. If you go past a group of people like this and people pick up their cell phones and start taking pictures, he would stop. And he would look,
look right, turn this way, turn that way. I mean, our leopard does her film shoots on her own because she knows she's got to walk camera left, camera right, away from camera, towards camera, and that's pretty much done. She's done it on her own. Shalati, the last shoot she did entirely on her own. I was putting on my gloves, getting my stick, putting on the meat bucket, doing everything. And they said, oh, great, thank you, Nicky, we're done. I said, but we haven't done. No, she did it. She did everything. She walked to camera, she snarled on the camera, she walked left, she walked right, she swished her tail. She did everything, she knows what to do.
Interestingly, they've had only one fatality on a movie set, and the culprit was a giraffe, of all things.
Have you ever been sued?
Yes, not sued, but claimed damages which were in a camera that were close to, too close to a giraffe, and the giraffe killed
him. With his neck.
One shot.
You don't expect
it's
that.
Stay away, stay away, stay away, stay away, stay away. And on the audio, because obviously he was filming the giraffe. And on the audio, actually, let's just go and see if the elephants are on their way back. On the audio of the camera, you could hear on the audio the sound guy say, back away, back away. You are too close. You're too close. And the camera says, no, this giraffe knows me. And the sound guy said to him again, Vicky said to you, you mustn't get close. Doof. Game, set, match.
I mentioned that the cats were caged, albeit in biggish ones. But of course they need exercise. And it's done by taking them out for a bit of running and jumping. Running on a lure, or jumping up and down boxes and platforms. Some volunteers and I watch from behind very high wire fencing while Vicky and her staff took the cats through their paces.
You know, to have that face coming at you in anger would, I think I'd die of fright, not of a lion attack.
They love us this. A piece of meat on the ground, and we have to both...
You know, I thought he would smell much more gamey, but he doesn't. Even his breath doesn't smell.
Get it first. He will get it first and take it on.
So what's the difference between this and a circus?
There was a story of a guy...
Here it's focusing mainly on training the muscles, making sure they're fit. In the circus, it's all about entertainment. We're here to see them, how they would act in the wild, I suppose. This is exactly how they would jump up onto a copy or a pile of rocks.
It's a brave man who does this work, and the ones on Glen Afrique have all volunteered for it, except those who work with the three elephants on the estate.
We had a guy that came from Zambia, I think. He'd been at an elephant sanctuary, something to do with elephants. He'd worked elephants, he'd managed elephants, he'd done everything. The elephants didn't like him at all. They threw stones at him, they broke branches off the trees, and accidentally, on purpose, threw the branches over their head and it hit the guy. They squashed him into the wall. They tripped him. They pushed him into the water. They splashed him. They did everything they could to make his life uncomfortable. And then when we didn't get the message, then they started chasing him. But, you know, they have a great sense of humor, elephants. And you could virtually see them chasing them, and at the last minute they'd break away. And you could see that smile. You know, the elephants have got that little sneaky smile. And as they'd break away and throw their head and flush back their ears and whatever, you could see them go, yes, that was fun. So eventually he said to us, I can't work with these elephants. And that's why with the elephant guys we have now, one was a gardener, one mixed concrete, and the third one was sort of a huntlanger, handyman sort of a guy. With elephants, you don't have a choice. The elephants choose their own keepers.
Can you give me a little tight summation how different the big cats are in your experience? A lion from a tiger, from a cheetah, from a leopard?
An African lion is dangerous. Nicely looked after. Keep a good relationship with him. You'll be fine. If you overstep the mark with any animal, but if you overstep the mark with a lion and you whatever, yeah, your life's going to be difficult, and there's a chance that he will go for you, eat you, and that's it. Tigers are always in negotiation with you. There's always a deal to be made. And they're quite cunning, and they are charming. They are dignified, and, you know, if something happens, it's, oh, what a terrible mistake we've just made. Cheetahs, bless their dear hearts, you can only really compare them to a group of very good-looking models, all beautiful. They don't need to work on their personality much. They're the blondes of the big cats. You know,
very precious, very dear, but they don't always get it. I think I'd have to say leopards are leopards. They're sharp. They've got quite a quirky sense of humour. Where lions, funny enough, don't really have any sense of humour. They're terribly funny, but they never do things because they think it's funny. Do you know what I mean? Elephants do naughty things because it's funny. But leopards have got quite a quirky sense of humour. I think leopards are so independent. They've got it so sorted. There's nothing that they tackle that they haven't thought about. Everything's pretty well managed. They're very strong in themselves. They're very definite. They'll fool with you a little bit and play with you and want to rub you and whatever. But as they'll do that, I have a little leopard here. She loves me to pieces and she'll rub against me and I'll rub her and I'll scratch her and whatever. And then she'll look at me out of the corner of her eye and she'll walk off and with her tail, she will flick my peak cap off my head every time.
The inimitable Vicky Brooker, champion of animals, great and small. That's it for this month. Thank you to my guests, to David Lamkin for research, and to Amy Amazing for putting the show together under huge pressure this time. There are more stories about people and animals in next month's edition of Potpourri, because I'm off to Hoedspruit again. It's known as the safari capital of South Africa, as you might know. But after that, I'm in your hands. My travels will be determined by the stories you send in. So please get your suggestions to me so that I can start planning my journeys. Cheers for now.